on behalf of our ministry, it's been a joy to here be with you, but I don't really need to give Ravi an introduction. You know who he is, and I hope, just want you to welcome him and trust this will be a blessing to you. God bless Ravi.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to be with you. I'm only on this session because nobody else was willing to do it. And they put the arm around me and said, would you be willing to consider that subject? And obviously this is a closed session. And I hope, and for obvious reasons, you know, the old Indian proverb is very true. Once you've cut off a person's nose, there's no point giving them a rose to smell. And so we're not trying to cut any noses off and then try to offer some sweet aroma of the splendid gospel and so forth. So I have to be very wise and very careful, and at the same time try and do some degree of justice to this subject. Possibly one of the most difficult worldview conflicts we now have in the global scene. And it's a lightning rod subject. I mean, there's almost nothing you can say without igniting passions on one side or the other. And yet in my travels, God has given me the opportunity to be in some of these tough situations. Before I begin, therefore, let me give you some backdrop information to how I'm going to approach this and also how I think we will try to end this. The first thing I want you to know is that there are many, many in this audience who are more qualified to address this than I am. And this is not some kind of a mock, humble statement. It's a very real statement. I've known some in the midst here. I won't name them who are living in these situations and have been a light and a tremendous force for the gospel in those settings much more than I have been. My birth and my background was in India, which is predominantly Hindu, but I did work very closely. In fact, the captain of my cricket team, Sultan Ahmed, was a very devout Muslim. We had lots of conversations before I began to believe anything, and have had conversations over the many countries with many scholars. I had a great one-hour conversation with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Bob Tigert was with me. We were one-on-one. Had a 2 to 3 hour conversation with the Chief of Islamic Studies at the University of Bethlehem in Israel. Had a tremendous interaction with him. He had a lot of things to say which were fascinating to hear. And at the end of it, he ended by saying, you know, Dr. Zacharias, he said, I don't like many of the things you've said today. He said, but I think you're a good man. I said, why do you say that? He said, because you came late for your appointment, and if you had come on time, I would not have been able to meet you. I said, well, I'm sorry I was late, but the security checks kept us backing us up. He said, I know, I'm not criticizing you. He said, the time you were supposed to come, I was lying on this floor in pain with a kidney stone attack. And you came half an hour late. Just before you came, I passed the kidney stone. And he opened the drawer and took out this little bottle and said, here is that stone. I thought he was going to present it to me, and I was happy for him to keep it to himself. But he said, so Allah told me you're a good man. You bring good signs, you bring a good omen, and I just want to lean over, hug you, and thank you for coming. Leaned over, kissed me both sides of the face, took me and introduced me to the rest of the faculty, and another intense conversation ended on some bridge building. So we've done this, and what I share with you, I share with a little bit of experience, not as much as some of you have. The other thing I want to say is, I believe the brightest days are yet ahead for this bridge. I really do. And I was talking to Victor before coming here, and Victor said in the next 2 to 3 years, he expects there'll be an explosion of a response. That may not be a good metaphor for this kind of subject, but there'll be a huge response that will come. And I think we are going to live to see that day as well. So no matter what is being said, bear that end scene in sight. And as we navigate at the end of my talk, I'm going to call LT and Stuart and Michael. And we'll be up front if there are any questions. We'd like to sort of put the lid on this subject in this setting, because tomorrow we'll have a Q&A time too and leave it open for other things. And I'm going to be careful and mention that worldview rather than just always using the name, because it may sound more adversarial, and that is really not the intent. So please bear that in mind. Can we begin with a word of prayer? Father, I thank you for these couple of days and for the men and women that you've brought from so many parts of this continent. I thank you for those who've been teaching and those who've been listening and the ones that our hearts are knit with over years of ministry and the new friends we are going to make here and have made here. And now I pray as we deal with this extremely sensitive issue that you'll give wisdom. You have said that you prepare us, that you will enable us to know what to say and what not to say. I truly pray that that is precisely what will happen this morning and in the remainder of the sessions. In the precious name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. If you look at the world of Islamic belief, you see the countries that are leading in numbers really are now from the non-Arab part of the world, because the largest Muslim nation in the world now is Indonesia. Obviously, various groups and sects among them, but Indonesia really ranks as number one, Pakistan, I believe, number two, and between India and Bangladesh, they come in at three or four, depending on a few million here or a few million there. When you log up the numbers, they vary in terms of global numbers. Generally speaking, the Christian world is seen as somewhere between 30 to 35%. The Muslim world at somewhere between 20 to 25%. But even when I was talking to the professor of Islamic studies in Bethlehem and he made the comment of how fast growing a religion it was, I said, I want to stop you right there. I said, because I do not accept your numerical calculation. He said, why not? I said, if you talk about it as the fastest growing, you will also have to add one qualifier as the fastest growing enforced religion in the world. He said, what do you mean? I said, the only way to test whether a faith is genuine or not is to take your foot off the necks of the people. And then you find out whether they truly believe this or not. I said, if you're willing to do that and tell me you will take your foot off the necks of the people, then give me your statistics, then I will buy into them. Right now, I simply cannot accept it. And he was quite surprised. I was flying into Jakarta from Kuala Lumpur, and the man sitting next to me was the Minister of Religion from Indonesia. And I asked him what brought him to Malaysia, and he said they were having a conference on their religion, and I said, what were you discussing? He said, well, because of the bad publicity that we have received, we just want to know how we can respond to the world to understand what our true beliefs are. I said, well, I appreciate that. I said, in fact, I'm a person who tries to dabble in world religions as well. In fact, your name is probably on my passport because I'm coming in to visit and do some guest lectures at the University of Jakarta. And as we began to converse, he also mentioned the large numbers, the large amount of following, and so on and so forth. He said, and you know, we are a very peaceable people. I said, yeah, doesn't your sacred book say that there is no compulsion in religion? He was ready to quote the chapter and verse. He said, yes, there isn't. I said, so are you telling me that in Indonesia, somebody who is a follower of your faith is free to also disbelieve? He paused for a moment and he said, why would they want to disbelieve? I said, I'm asking you whether they are free to disbelieve or not. I said, you're coming from Malaysia, going to Indonesia, back your homeland. I said, the Malaysian will tell you that if he converts from the Islamic faith to the Christian faith, he will have to go before a tribunal to explain his reasons. But if the reverse takes place, there is no reason to come before a tribunal. I said, you know that to be true. I said, so are you telling me the people in your land are free to disbelieve? He said, these things become very complex, you know. And he was right. It is very, very complex. And when you understand the history of the religion, you understand the complexity of it. And you throw into the mix the historical experience, the bad experience in the years when Christendom was wielding the sword, and all of the methodologies that we have gotten into, the geopolitical maneuverings that have taken place, the hate with which sometimes people are raised, the avenging spirit, we've got to set the balances straight, the old idea of what Bishop Tutu said, you know, you came with the Bible, we had the land, now you have the land and the Bible as well, we have very little left. Those
caricatures and those explanations also have to be thrown into the mix. And you understand then the mindset and why it responds the way it does. And invariably, therefore, a skeptic will listen to you once he has taken away all those prejudices and understands that you're not one of those who believed in that kind of methodology. It is very important that we understand that. If you do not understand the bent of mind of the questioner, everything you say will be distorted within that very filter through which everything is going. The very word Christian spells a bad word to some of them, as you know, because of all of the connotations that it carries. All that aside, about a third of the world is theoretically Christian, nominally Christian, and then about a quarter of the world is following Islam. After that, you've got about 1 billion people in the world who profess to be Hindus, and then you've got the Buddhists, the Jains, the Sikhs, the Zoroastrians, and then the skeptics all thrown into the mix. So if you really take numerically the three leading religions of the world, you've got Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism. India, of course, one of the most religious countries in the world. In the 600s, the face of the world was going to change, and it has changed unalterably. Born about 570, this young lad, dying in 632 at the age of 62, 63, changed the face of this part of the world. And I think Ali Dashti, the Iranian journalist, in writing his book, 23 Years, The Life of the Prophet Muhammad, basically encapsulates that in those 2.5 decades of the period of the revelation, so much was going to transpire that the world was never going to look the same again. And he walked into a mix. He walked into a mix of polytheism. If you take a background look of what this part of the world believed before he came, then you will also understand what it was that was being thrown into the transformation period. There were multiple gods. There were idolatries being carried on. If you name just the top 10 tutelary gods of the period of that time, you begin to see what it was that he was railing against and what it was that he was battling against. Of course, he never did it all by himself. When at the age of 40, he began to get the revelation through the angel, and Khadija basically told him not to be afraid, not to be despairing, not to be fearful, that this was probably the revelation that God was going to give to him. And in a remarkable use of cultural understanding, with the brilliance and the beauty of language combined, and then introducing doctrine into it, he was able to transform and give an identity to a people who at that time were disparate groups and had no identity at all. The Jews had their identity, the Christians had their identity, and that's why actually in the early part of the Quran, if you read the second surah, for example, there are some extraordinary verses that sometimes even Muslim professors whom I talk to are left rather confounded with how to explain some of them. Look at this verse, for example, verse 122 in the second surah. O children of Israel, remember my favor wherewith I favored you and how I preferred you above all my creatures. A bit of a shocking verse to read there in the Quran. I said to the professor in Bethlehem, I said, you're right here in the land. What does this verse actually mean that I preferred you above everyone else and all of my creatures? Do you really think they were a favored group at one stage? And he sort of hooed and hawed and tried to narrow it down and not able to truly get out of the argument he was trying to build in terms of trying to explain this. But when the young prophet of Islam came and started to see all of this, you remember too, there was some sequence of events that took place which also appealed to the culture. Through natural catastrophe, the Kaaba had been destroyed, and then the Quraysh rebuilt it. And they then said, whoever is the first one to walk in, he will be the one whom we will trust, Al-Amin. And they waited and waited, and in walked Muhammad, and he became the one that they were going to trust. So through a combination of what they called these manifestations and the brilliance of the articulation in the context of the language, he won the favor, and then through the sword, through battle, through sheer determination, mastered that part of the world through a lot of genius. And actually, Ali Dashti, the Iranian journalist, whose book, by the way, is really worth reading, but unfortunately, he was very, very candid in his critique of the system and just disappeared on the face of the earth. Ali Dashti claimed to be a Muslim, a devout Muslim indeed, but he made the comment that he did not believe for a moment that the Quran was a perfect book. He said it has so many linguistic errors in it that the laws of grammar had to be adjusted to accommodate. That's his statement. That the laws of grammar had to be adjusted in order to attain this. And points are made repeatedly that the original version that was given to us 2 to 3 years after Muhammad died, there were several editions after that. Toby Lester, in the January issue of Atlantic Monthly 1999, has a list of all the variant readings that were added in the years to come under the third caliphate of Osman. And he points those things out. And so Ali Dashti pointed it out too, but Ali Dashti ended up paying with his life. He just disappeared. He has never been heard from since. He wanted the book to be published posthumously, but it was printed, and he was defending his faith, but at the same time being candid about what the book is and is not. And his life then, he just disappeared along with several other scholars. In my book, Light in the Shadow of Jihad, I have listed several Egyptian, Algerian, and so on, who critiqued the book and ended up paying with their life and just disappeared off the face of the earth. But the world changed. The world changed dramatically. And as we look back now upon the last 1,300 years, I want to point out for you a few things. Number one, what is the incoherence within the system as I see it as a Christian believer? Why do I not believe the system myself? There are many, many theological points I could give to you. But also bear in mind that these arguments and these issues do not necessarily lead to persuading somebody to becoming a Christian. But when they are on that thin line between their belief and another belief, gently use these arguments, raise the right degree of doubt so that it causes them to honestly question and find out where the truth is. Apologetics is not the main course. The main course is the gospel and the love of God. Apologetics is the seasoning. Bear that in mind. Apologetics is the seasoning. It is the salt and pepper you put into the appetizing meal that you're serving, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ. So just bear that in mind. This is not to sort of cut somebody down at their knees. If you cut them down at their knees, they're not going to be left standing to listen to what it is you are saying. So a gentle dose is all that. Just enough to plant that seed of doubt. Do you know the largest number of responses we are facing and seeing today are men and women who are coming to Christ from that background through dreams and visions? I met one of them in one land I shall leave unnamed. He was from Iraq. And my wife and I were invited to have lunch with him. And he said, I won't give you my real name. My real name is not Joshua, but I'll say I'm Josh, solid looking guy. I said, tell me your story. He said, well, I was in Saddam's army. He said, I was trained to do two things. Number one, to kill without feelings. And number two, to make false passports. To kill without feelings and to make false passports. He said, Mr. Ravi, I started to have a dream about Jesus one night. Two nights, three nights, the dreams continued. And finally, I told my mother, she said, you better get out of the country, your brothers are going to kill you. He said, I'm not going to become a follower of Jesus. She said, I can see the signs. He said, you don't need to worry. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. He said, I left the country. I arrived into this country 7 years in a row. Every night I had the same dream. And then I met up with this Chinese businessman and he said, he's on your trail. He's on your trail. You're not going to be run away fast enough. He said, I have now become a Christian. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm at seminary in this country. This was an Asian country. It was in the West. He said, I am studying and preparing to go back to my country. And he said, I just wanted to talk to you because I've heard some of your tapes, read some of your books. I want to be trained in apologetics. And as we talked, the man was just full of the fire of the Lord. I said, "Are you married?" He said, "Who'd want to marry a man who made false passports and killed people without feelings? And now I want to go back to my own country." I said, "How are you going to get back?" He said, "I make passports. I'll get back." You know, this remarkable fearlessness of a young guy. I was so impressed with him, and he said, "My story is not the only story. I know stories of many where dreams are coming night after night, because one of the major doctrines of that worldview is the idea of angels and the intricate doctrine of angels and visions and so on. God is using their worldview through which to break down the barriers." If you have read the book Persian Springs, the testimonies of so many Iranian converts, almost all of them have, that I read there, had come through visions and dreams. So it is just, I think, a remarkable thing that God is breaking down and taking the situations in which we are finding ourselves in order to bring the truth to these people. So don't think of apologetics as a sledgehammer. If you do, it'll knock you down before it knocks the opposition down. Bear that in mind. What is the incoherence within the worldview? I want to give to you at least five of them. The first one is this. How does a claimant to prophetic status who claims to be the prophet to the whole world restrict the authority of his communication to one language? I think it's a legitimate question. When there are billions of people in this world with so many different languages, and if you start talking to a believer in this worldview, he or she will tell you, "You really don't understand this because you don't speak the language. If you read it in the original language, you would see the miracle, you would see the beauty." Isn't it fascinating? When Jesus looked at the rulers and the scholars, he did not point to them as typifying the kingdom, but he said, "Unless any one of you becomes like this little child, in like manner you also will not enter the kingdom of heaven." He took the capacity to represent the kingdom of God in the simplicity and innocence of a child who probably could not speak one sentence without butchering the language. This is critical to know. Because when I was talking to the Mufti, he made the comment that Jesus did not come to the world. He only came to the Jews as the Messiah, and they'd reject. Every one of them was telling me the same line. I said, "Where did you get that from? Where did you get that from? It's a caricature of what the scriptures say." He said, "Our prophet is the prophet to the world." I said, "Restricted to one language. You cannot be an honest representative of a worldview if you first of all say it is restricted in authority to one language, and number two, take away the power to critique and test it whether it is true." You hear what I'm saying? If I say to you that I am coming up with a theory on the law of gravity that is at variance to the existing laws, and you say to me, "I want to analyze it," I'll say, "The moment you analyze it, I'm going to finish you off." You simply cannot be taken seriously in the world of the academy. You know, it's fascinating right now. The king of Saudi Arabia came to, I was in Washington when this was being discussed. In fact, I was with the president of Georgetown University the night before this happened. He was at a meeting that I was speaking. And the king in Saudi Arabia has given $20 million to Georgetown and $20 million to Harvard University to set up the chair of Islamic studies for better understanding of the Islamic worldview in those two countries. Very fair. This week, a New York Times journalist asked him, "If you really want better understanding, are you going to open a chair for Christian studies in Saudi Arabia?" You know what his answer was? He says, "There's 0% Christians in my country." And the journalist, to her credit, said, "Isn't that the point I'm raising with you? If there's 0%, how are you going to understand? Is understanding only going one way?" He never answered the question. Suppose, for example, a devout Brahmin and a devout Muslim met. And the Muslim says to the Brahmin, "You know, you really can't understand the original language here, so you really cannot understand my Quran. And the devout Brahmin says, you know what your problem is? You're not a Brahmin. You have no right to interpret the Vedas. That's why you don't understand it. Where are they going to go? It's a dead end. If one says you don't have my caste, so you cannot interpret my scriptures, and the other says you don't have my language, say, where does this go? Unless a piece of document is willing to subject itself to the open criticism of the academic world, it cannot really be taken seriously academically. It can only be taken seriously by imposition. And I've said this in the public square. I've said this at universities where the 99% of the audience believes this very thing that I'm dealing with. And I will, you know, sometimes I wonder when I say those things, have I lost my head in the process or what? But I just say this to them. Forget right now that I'm talking to you as a Christian. I say, I'm just asking you seriously. Do you want me to take you seriously when you've told me I cannot understand this on the basis of the language? And that's why there are translations, but they are not ultimately authoritative. Secondly, it abolishes our authority without an original with which to condemn it. It says, for example, that, you know, the Zabur, the Psalms, the Torah, the Book of Moses, and the Injil are the three other authorities, and then the Quran, and the other three are lost. So they have taken away our authority. And they have only retained those. And my question to them is, were these authoritative and absolute? Yes. But then how did we lose them? If God gave three absolute revelations and we lost them, now you've got a fourth absolute revelation, how do you know this is not going to be lost as well? But they've completely misunderstood what the Injil Muqaddas is all about. What is the Holy Gospel? The gospel has as its centerpiece the cross. Without the cross, there is no gospel. So to even call it the gospel is the misuse of language. There is no gospel in the Gnostic writers. There is no other gospel. If anyone preached to you anything except Christ crucified, says Paul, he is preaching another gospel. It is not the gospel. The gospel is in the centerpiece, the cross of Jesus Christ. So it abolishes our authority without replacing or without having one to compare it to. Now, I know you'll have questions in this, but suppose I say to you, I have a meter long measuring stick here. And I say to you, I'm not sure it is right or wrong, but I'm going to tell you it is wrong. And you say to me, have you got something by which to measure it to tell me it is wrong? And he says, no. I know what the devout scholar will say. Oh, what we have of the gospel is critiqued in the Quran, but the original one is not here at all. Do you know that is one of the most incredible statements that can be made? There are so many original, within a matter of years, of the writers of the gospel. You've got, within the first century, you've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and probably Acts as well floating around. That, what's his name, Bruce Metzger of Princeton University, hardly the bastion of conservatism. Bruce Metzger says there's a 99.4% accuracy of our present text compared to probably what the original was. It's a remarkable statement. A 99.4% accuracy. This tells you the honesty with which the Christians deal with their subjects. If there is a passage of scripture where there are one or two variants, we will say, until we get the original, we will have to go with this, which has more versions of it than that. But no fundamental doctrine of the gospel is affected in the process. Whether 2,200 went to war or 2,300 went to war does not change the gospel. But this nitpicking goes on. The scripture is more authoritatively supported than any other ancient book because the scriptures allows itself to be critiqued. When I was in Tirana, Albania, I'd finished speaking to the members of parliament and the director of the museum came to me. He said, I want to give you a special treat today. I said, you do? He said, yes. I said, I don't have that much of time. He said, no, sir. Please come. I want to give you a special treat today. I am the director of the local museum. So Bob Tigert, our videographer, was with me and two or three of us went. When we arrived at the museum, there were guards all around the building, and I walked into his office. We were ushered in, and he said, "Let's go." He takes me into this room, and there's a room full of his staff, and he says, "I want you to speak to them." I said, "I thought you were going to give me a treat." He said, "The treat is going to come later. Speak to them about what you spoke to the members of parliament today." Albania is the most atheistic nation in the world. So we're finished speaking, and then he says, "Now's your treat." The doors open, and three armed guards come in with something in their hand. And they brought us some rubber gloves and gave me the rubber gloves. Said, "This is the version of Chrysostom from the 4th century, the Gospel of Matthew." Bob remembers that. I got tears in my eyes. I said, "I'm holding St. Chrysostom's New Testament translation of Matthew." He said, "Yes, it was excavated in one of our monasteries in 900. And the Enver Hoxha, the dictator, had locked it up and was actually going to destroy it. He said, "This is the first time in decades we've even taken it out from a safe because I want to give you the honor of holding this in your hand." And as I looked at it, it was the 26th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. Do you know what it was? The story of the woman with the alabaster ointment. And I'm reading it there in Greek, and it says, "Wherever the gospel is preached, there shall also this story be told of what this woman did to me." 1,600 years later, it was like it was done on a computer, justified margins with gold ink. The gospel has survived for centuries. And when somebody tells you that we do not have the original, ask them how you measure whether you have an authentic document or not. And you go farther and farther and farther back, and you will see the homogeneity of the text coming through the closer you get to the original. So there's an incoherence, first in the linguistic demand, second in the abolishing of our authority. Thirdly, it overrules an absolute while affirming a new one, which is self-defeating. It overrules an absolute, which is and brings a new one, which I think is self-defeating. If absolute A has been lost, replaced by absolute B, if A could be lost, so could B, unless you somehow come up with some other surrounding argument to justify your own position. I could give you a fascinating illustration here of a conversation I had with one man in Amman, Jordan, the first time I went there, but it may be too high risk a discussion to give here. Around the table sometime, I'll be happy to tell you that. But we basically got into that same idea, and it is this, something like this, you know, if, let me see if I can try and do this as gently as I can. I said to him, "Was Jesus a prophet of God?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Can a prophet of God lie about himself?" He paused, he said, "No." I said, "Jesus claimed to be the only way to God. If what he said about himself is true, then what your prophet said about him is false, that he was not the Son of God." He said, "That is correct." I said, "On the other hand, if what Jesus said is false, then your prophet would still be wrong. Because he said Jesus was right in what he said." I was getting some passport pictures made. He grabbed the pictures out of my hand and left. Norm Camp, the missionary, was around me. And actually, he'd asked Norm Camp the questions. And Norm Camp said, "He's asking you. You answer them." And I got into that little discussion with him. Now, I know he didn't think on his feet quickly enough. Had he thought on his feet quickly enough, he'll say, "That's what you say Jesus claimed. I don't believe he actually claimed that." And so that throws the ball into your court to be able to then defend it properly. But the absolute is a bizarre notion. Number four, the man from that worldview reserves the right to demean Jesus from being the Son of God to a prophet, but would attempt to hurt you if you took his belief in his prophet and demeaned him to an ordinary person. Follow what I'm saying. How can you discuss on these two grounds? If you reserve the right to offend me, but you are not giving me the right to offend you at the same time, it's not an equal conversation. You're equivocating in the rules of the game. Imagine this. Imagine playing a football game with two different sets of rules. Can you play a game like that? What if you said, anytime you score a goal, it doesn't count? But every time I score a goal, it counts too. Would you ever win? No. That is the way these discussions go. I have heard people say all kinds of things. I mean, I remember, I shouldn't bring people to the fore here, but I remember being in some places where the Bible was demeaned and all kinds of names and things being called about it. But if I did the same about the holy book of that land, I would not get out of there as a free man. I've seen in Indian newspapers some Hindu scholars really lambaste the Christian faith. But if I did the same thing in newspapers with them, I did an interview with the India Times in New York City, and this gal was just goading me. She wanted me to make something that would be provocative. And I said, you know, you've got to respect other beliefs. You've got to hear them. You've got to da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. She says, yeah, but do you really believe that in the caste system some people can come as monkeys and this? I said, no, I don't believe that. And she makes this a big deal in her art. I got so much of hate mail from that, from Hindu scholars and so on. They didn't even know she goaded to make sure I made a comment like that. But at my age, I don't lose any sleep over those things. I read one or two, and I'm onto my back, and it really doesn't bother me one bit now, because I know the boys face to face would never be able to defend what it is they're actually trying to say to you. So I present to you this, the right to demean, and that's why it is very critical. We not demean, but we find a way of addressing the issue without demeaning the individual. Fifthly and lastly, they have taken that which is the attribute of Jesus Christ and given it to a book. They have taken that which was the attribute of Jesus Christ, perfect, flawless, the final expression, and given it to a book. And it's very difficult to talk of a perfect book. How does one talk of a perfect book? Is a perfect book in X number of words? Does that mean even God is not able to perfect that anymore? It's like having an infinite library. Can you have an infinite library? What if you take one book and tear it into two from an infinite library? You've got one more. So when you talk about a perfect book, are you saying that every word there was perfectly chosen? If that is true, then I think you have to create all kinds of other defenses, which I will try to move to here quickly because time is flowing by here. So number one, the incoherence. Number two, what are the differences? The differences are several. Let me race through them. Number one, the issue of violence and sensuality is clearly the hallmark of that worldview. You can see it. You can go to surah after surah and you can see, for example, even a mandate not to take friends of the Jews and the Christians is a fascinating description of somebody who is propagating an idea and telling you don't even make friends of these people. You know, it is fascinating how Jesus went to the Samaritan who was not of the house of Israel, as it were. He goes to the adulterous woman and lifts her up. He goes to the outcasts of society to befriend them. And it was a Pharisee who said, if this man only knew the character of the woman he is talking to, he would have had nothing absolutely to do with her. There is the range and reach of the gospel and the whole idea of violence and sensuality. Let me put it this way. I have never hesitated to say this in private conversation and in public discourse. The view of marriage in the New Testament is drastically different to the view of marriage in the Quran. Drastically different. The desacralization, I think, of sexuality is very serious here. I had a long talk for about 3 hours with a man in Jakarta on this very issue. And at the end of it, he had to say, if what you're telling me is theoretically true, I would have to grant to you that there is a supremacy of marital love here that is not true in my faith. That marriage is exclusive. Sexuality is sacred. Jesus said very clearly, that when you join your body to another person, there is a spiritual entailment from that that is so sacred that it can only be broken by somebody who chooses to profane it, or by death. The sanctity of marriage and sexuality is at its highest pedestal in the Christian faith. And whenever you violate that, you violate the notion of the purity of love. There is no doubt that in the gospel story of marriage, it stands at the highest rung of the ladder of what this is meant to be, the consummate expression of physicality with the spiritual concomitant, or the other way around, a spiritual commitment with the physical concomitant, which is goes hand in hand, and what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. This is remarkable. And if you violate that, you will find what happens to the home. You break that, you'll find what happens. This is exactly, of course, what Jacob ended up doing. And notice the jealousy. Notice the disharmony. Notice the breakdown and all of the scheming that came. This gospel here is different. Number two, Jesus did not come to build a nation. He resisted the urge again and again and again to build a nation. He did not come to establish a geopolitical theory. He did not come to take hold of the reins of government. But I have talked to Jamal Badawi, for example, the brilliant scholar who takes on all comers. Badawi agrees with what I'm saying to you, that it in its core is a geopolitical theory. Very different even to the Judaism of the day. The Judaism of its day was a narrow territory given to a particular people in a covenant relationship for a particular time. It was never a cosmic scheme of conquering the rest of the nations of the world. This is a geopolitical theory. There is no doubt about it. At the core, it's a geopolitical theory with its legal system and all of it. That's why recently in Canada, as an attempt was made to introduce the Sharia into Ontario, there were actually many of the Muslim faith, a woman in particular, who pled with the government not to let it happen. She said, "You're changing the nation. It is a new political theory." And to her great credit, she fought it tooth and nail. And I think ultimately the Prime Minister of Ontario had to step into it and said, "We will not admit two legal systems into the land." And those who were trying to promote it had to back away. Fourthly, it is this. It is a completely different understanding of sin. When you look at the prodigal son's story, you see the prodigal son coming to himself and coming home. I remember an Islamic scholar said to me, "All right, you talk about the prodigal son." He said, "Where is the cross in the prodigal son's story?" I said, "I'll tell you that if you tell me where the prophet is in the prodigal son's story." I said, "I don't see any prophet going out there to give him a perfect revelation to bring him back." I said, "He came to himself. He recognized that his heart was lost and he came home to his father." And I said, "The parables only teach one truth. You can't take, if you take every parable and start pushing everything to its ulterior limit, you end up with actually nudity. In a sense, you know, if you see a fellow with two coats and you want to give one away, or go and see about somebody who doesn't have one, and you'll give half, and at the end of it, you'll be wearing nothing." And which, thank God, will never happen for Hollywood, because there'll be no marketing genius involved in that. Nobody will make money on it if we all wore nothing. And that's why that kind of thing will never happen. But the whole idea of misunderstanding and misrepresenting a parable and the gospel. Fifthly, the destruction of the cross and the concept of salvation. It says in Surah 4 that they killed him not and he did not die. That is the only worldview in this universe that believes that. The Jews believed he was crucified. The Romans believed he was crucified. The Greeks believed he was crucified. The pagans believed he was crucified. This is the only worldview that says he wasn't. How can you go to a historical system that takes a historical fact and actually denies its historicity? It is the only worldview that says that he was not crucified. Whether you read Tacitus, or whether you read Josephus, or you read Suetonius, or read all of these boys who were writing in those days, you say, the crucifixion of Christ was a known fact of history. It is so embedded in history that even those who were his antagonists did not deny it. So it's the destruction of the cross and the concept of salvation. Number six, the misunderstanding of the doctrine of the Trinity. Sometimes in the Quran, it refers to Mary as being one of the personages of the Trinity. Dr. Akbar Haq, the Billy Graham associate, whose father, Abdul Haq, was a great, great Muslim convert preacher in Delhi. I remember hearing him once in the early days of my conversion. Dr. Haq, in his book, does a marvelous job of expounding on this misunderstanding in the Islamic world of the doctrine of Trinity. Number six, that all of the above shows a complete paucity, an inability to understand what it means to have a relationship with God. What it means to have a relationship with God. God is so distant that he never comes near. God is so transcendent that he never becomes imminent. God is so indescribable in a sense that even to attempt to describe him becomes blasphemy. And yet, I want you to know that the woman at the well ran back to her people and said, come and see the one who told me everything about myself and still gave himself to me and gave me that drink, gave me that living water. Lastly, the desire on that worldview to build a kingdom on earth, but for us as the Christian, it is the rule of Christ in our hearts. I want to close with some very important closing statements here. And that is this. There are cultural contrasts, and I think we have to end on that note, five or six things. Number one, it's a view of history that is very different in the Middle East as it is in many other parts of the world, Middle East and Far East. In the West, we have no concept of history. Anything that is 2 years old is old. We don't think of that as anything to do with us today. The story is told of a Western diplomat who was sitting next to Zhou Enlai, the Chinese prime minister, some years ago. And the Western diplomat was told, the Orientals really love history. So if you want to get into history, why don't you discuss history with them? Because the fellow wasn't prepared. So he sat next to Zhou Enlai at the dinner and he looks at him and he says, what do you think of the French Revolution? And Zhou Enlai paused and said, it's too soon to tell. 2 centuries later, it is too soon to tell. For us, 2 years ago, it's gone, it's passé, it's over with. We want quick fix solutions only for the now. So the cultural contrast is between a culture that will not forget the past and a culture for which 2 years old is too old. That is the mismatch that we are facing in this kind of thing. I remember an Iranian friend of mine, we were having lunch around a table, 7 Iranian friends and myself. And he said, Brother Ravi, he said, you know how difficult it is to get a conversation going in my land? I said, why? He said, let me illustrate it to you this way. There was a journalist who was doing a survey and he went to Biafra. And he said to a Biafran, what is your opinion on the shortage of food in this world? And the Biafran said, what is food? So he went to America and he said to the American, what is your opinion on the shortage of food in this world? And the American said, what is shortage? So he went to Moscow and he said to the Moscovite, what is your opinion on the shortage of food in this world? And the Moscovite says, what is opinion? So he came to the Middle East and he asked the Middle Easterner, what is your opinion of the shortage of food in this world? And the Middle Easterner says, what is? He says, we will never get into the heart of a discussion because we won't get past the first two words. This is a real cultural clash when we start. Number two, those of us who live in the West have done injustice to understand where the true believers in the Middle East are actually coming from. Sometimes we have taken a stand against the very groups among whom the gospel has made the greatest inroads because we've got a political theory going behind it and we have forgotten what is really happening to believers who in some instances are suffering. Do you know what one man said to me in Bethlehem? He took me for lunch and then took me into his church. He said, do you know who's the loneliest man in Bethlehem at Christmas time and at any time? He said, it is the Muslim Palestinian convert. He has no place to go. He has no place to go. And we in the West sometimes forget the hurt and the pain that has followed in these kinds of things where political theories have been injected into things, and we have forgotten the very ones that are responding are sometimes the ones we end up taking stands against and have brought such great disparagement and hurt to. We must understand that. Thirdly, firm family ties are critical in bridging this culture. Brother Victor was chatting with me before, and I've known the Hashway family for years. I'm so thrilled to see them here. I knew the elder statesman, Albert Hashway, was a man of God and a man of vision. And when I was in my 20s, I went there and was preaching in that church and got to know the Hashway family so well. And Victor was telling me some time ago, and even today, he has a television broadcast on the family. He says he's getting scores and scores of letters from people who are writing, wanting to find more answers for their spouses, for themselves, and for their children. The bridge today of the family is very critical and very key, because in this culture of our world today, the family is falling apart. You know, when I grew up in Delhi, and I thought L.T. Wilson share this, I grew up with kids who would never have violated the moral law. I had never crossed a boundary line in sexual promiscuity growing up. I wouldn't have thought of it. It was anathema to me. I wouldn't have thought of doing that, and I wasn't even a believer. I just thought it was just wrong to, and I don't think a single buddy of mine, whatever their faith, had crossed those lines. Today, the boys are just playing havoc with their bodies and doing all kinds of things. And pornography is raping the minds of young men to destroy their homes. And the Middle East is not free of this. I think Sammy years ago had told me one of the biggest markets in Lebanon was in these nasty videos and these pornography videos that were floating around. Isn't it wonderful to have an example of a godly home and show what it is that it is meant to be like and the envy with which people look at it? Fourthly, don't be surprised to recognize divine intervention. I'm seeing this again and again and again. God is intervening. God is intervening. You know, I believe there are parts of the world today that have been shut down for years that I think we are going to see a massive moving of Christ in these places. The turning point may well have come a few years ago in an infamous incident. At the University of Jakarta, they invited me to give a lecture on why I'm a Christian, and they thought there'll be 200 to 300. There were over 2,000 of them in attendance. Over 2,000. For 3 hours, they were listening. And the questions were profound. And you see the response coming, and they'll come and embrace you, and they'll put their arm in yours and just tell you, thank you for sharing what you have. I believe I'm going to go back home. I see a dear friend here from that I met just recently in Turkey. And when I was in one of their cities in Turkey, a television gal, a young gal, who was from the particular faith that I'm speaking about this morning, came to me. She walked forward for the second night. I'm trying to remember that it is in Ankara or Istanbul. I don't remember. Sanem, you might if you were there. I don't know. But she walked up and she said to me, I want a question for you. She said, I'm not a Christian. I believe in her own faith as she was talking about it. Lovely, sweet young lady. She said, I have so many questions for you. I said, why don't you ask your hardest one first? She said, how can God have a son? And we began to talk. And I said to her, how can a barren woman who's a virgin become pregnant? Explain to me the miracle of that. And as we began to talk, I said, do you have a Bible? She said, no. I said, if I give you one, will you take it? She said, yes. The lady who was standing next to her said to me, I have already brought her one for tonight. She came here last night and I brought her tonight. So I said, would you go back and read the Gospel of John tonight and ask God to reveal himself to you if Jesus is really his son to speak to you? You know what she said to me? I am already a different young woman to the woman that walked in here tonight. She said, I'm going to walk out of here and look at a different world to the world that I came in. And she wiped the tears away and said, thank you so much for what's happened in my life tonight. Young gal in the media for whom the gospel pierced, and she began to see that little ray of light shining. There are thousands like this all over the world, folks, and I think you and I are going to live to see the day. Two more thoughts. Number one, pray. Pray for children who grow up with hate, who do not have the answer of love, who do not have the answer of love. Pray for them. And lastly, I say this. When Hagar prayed, "Oh, that Ishmael might live," God didn't turn her prayer down, you know. He promised that he would bless them too. Let's not stand in the way of what God wants to do. Let me close with this illustration. That will take about 15 minutes for questions. Last year, I was invited by the former Archbishop of Canterbury to be part of about a five or six man team to go and visit the leaders in Israel, including the Palestinian leadership and the Israeli leadership. We were to meet with Yasser Arafat, we were to meet with Ariel Sharon, and many of these planned meetings and all. We spent about 1.5 hours at Shimon Peres's office and talked as a peace mission. And on the last day, we were to meet with Sheikh Talal, who was one of the founders of Hamas. He had served many years in prison. So Sheikh Talal invited the six of us over. My traveling associate, Nate, who travels with me, was with me on that. And we sat down in his home for lunch, and he had a solidly built young son who had been released from prison recently. And Sheikh Talal himself had served 18 years, I believe, in prison. Arafat's right-hand man was sitting right next to me, puffing away. The room was full of smoke. He had many, many children, this Sheikh Talal did. He was a decent man. He really wanted peace. He said, "I'm tired of losing my children." He'd lost several children. So finally, I asked him a tough question. I said, "Sheikh Talal, what do you think of suicide bombing?" He said, "I'm against all forms of killing innocent people. I'm against all forms of killing." And we'd had a lovely lunch at his home, and George Carey and all were about to stand up and leave. I said, "Sheikh, can I share one thing with you before I go?" I said, "I know you're a Muslim and I'm a Christian, and what I share with you may not be your belief, but I think I need to share it with you before I go." He nodded. I said, "You know, thousands of years ago, there was a man called Abraham, who you claim is the patriarch of your faith, and I claim the patriarch of my faith. He took his son to the top of a mountain not far from here. Remember the story?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You say it's Ishmael." I said, "It's Isaac." I said, "It's not important right now." I said, "But you remember what happened? As God was about to bring that axe down, as it were, God said, 'Stop.'" He nodded. I said, "What did God say after that?" "I myself will provide." He nodded. I said, "Sheikh Talal, on a different hill, not far from here, 2,000 years ago, God brought his own son. He honored his promise that he was going to provide. And this time, the axe did not stop." I said, "I just want you to know, until you and I receive the son God has provided, we will be sacrificing our own sons on the battlefields of this world." There was pin drop silence in the room. We went and hugged him, kissed me on my face as he kissed the others, and we walked out of there. And George Carey put his arm around me and he just squeezed me and said, "That was of God." That's all he said, "That was of God." And ladies and gentlemen, our Lord died for all of mankind. And may you live that life of love. We are not in a fight for land. We are in a battle for the souls of men and women. When you're fighting for land, you can destroy the enemy and win the land. When you're battling for the souls, you cannot destroy the enemy. You must win them. And so my challenge to you is, if you're giving them a rose to smell, don't cut off the nose. Understand where they're coming from and let Christ shine in his beauty. And that is more beautiful than any book or language, because the human heart hungers not for language. It hungers for a relationship, and if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. That is my talk to you, carefully measured, maybe not that carefully at points, but thank you for giving me a hearing. You've been wonderful, and patient. And if there's anything you disagree with, chances are you're right and I'm wrong. But thanks for listening to me anyway. God bless you.